What does motion sound like? With Kizikans free shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Tomorrow, October 9th, Afghanistan holds its first ever presidential election. Hamid Karzai, the U.S.-backed interim president, is the front runner, facing 15 rivals. The democratic exercise, coming 3 years after American forces led the ouster of the Taliban, is remarkable. More than 10 million Afghans are registered to vote. But Afghanistan remains something short of a democratic miracle. Hamid Karzai has been essentially unable to campaign because of security threats beyond his Kabul compound. 20,000 American troops have not been enough to bring national security. The country continues to face enormous challenges. Tonight on Point, we'll hear voices from Kabul and here in the United States. These conversations were taped this afternoon so we could include voices from Afghanistan. So we won't be able to take your calls this hour. But we hope you'll listen with us as we take stock of Afghanistan on Election Eve. Joining me now from Kabul is Anne Bernard, who's been covering the run-up to Saturday's election for the Boston Globe. Anne, thanks very much for being with us from Afghanistan tonight.
Thanks a lot.
So, Anne, give us that general overview. It's only a few hours, Kabul time, until voting begins. How does it look there?
Well, today was very quiet in Kabul. Last night, a rocket attack hit the U.S. base here, but there were no casualties. The streets were pretty empty today, but people started to come out and shop towards the end of the day when it started to look as though there wouldn't be any violence today. And people seem very excited about coming out to vote. Many people say that they're not sure if their vote will matter, that they're afraid that there will be reprisals if they don't vote for the strong man in their neighborhood. But an equal number of people are just excited that this is one step towards a more democratic system.
And paint the national picture for us. We've heard this number, and it's an impressive one, 10.5 million voter registrations in Afghanistan. How many polling places? How secure? How much international oversight? What's the general picture as we head into this vote?
Well, there are 10.5 million people registered to vote, which is significantly more than the estimated number of eligible voters. So no one's exactly sure how many people are going to show up. And one question is whether the polling places will be able to handle everybody in one day when poll workers have had very little time to train. Many people are illiterate and may be holding a pen for the first time as they try to fill out their ballot. There's high security at the polling places in Kabul. They started putting up concertina wire and extra precautions around some of the polling places today. Earlier this week, I was down in Gardez in southeast Afghanistan, where U.S. Marines and Army troops are helping with everything from ferrying ballots to faraway polling places in the mountains to protecting the security perimeter around the area where they will be counting the votes from four provinces.
And when Afghans stand in the polling booth tomorrow, what will they see on the ballot?
Well, the ballot has 16 people on it at this point, including interim president Hamid Karzai. The ballot shows the pictures of all of the candidates' faces as well as symbols for the benefit of people who can't read. Abdul Rashid Dostum, a warlord in the north, has a horse. Masouda Jalal has the symbol of a loaf of bread and wheat. It's a real question how many people are going to recognize all of the candidates. People may recognize just one person from their region. They may recognize the president. But many people don't have information about all of the candidates.
And there's been some concern about intimidation at the polls. What's the reading on that at this point, Anne?
Well, there have been several reports out in the past few weeks that suggest that Afghans' biggest fear is not only that there will be physical attacks at the polls by Taliban insurgents, but also that local commanders, some of whom have been U.S. allies, will intimidate the population into voting for them if they are a candidate or for the candidate that they support. In some cases, that's President Karzai. In other cases, it's one of his rivals. So I traveled to northwestern Afghanistan last week, and everyone said, we're not afraid, we're not intimidated, but yet a striking 99% of the people we talked to said they were going to vote for the local warlord in that region. So it does leave open a question of how free people feel to choose.
And I'm sure that a public opinion polling is difficult, if not impossible, there. What is the expectation of the outcome of this vote? Does Karzai appear to have a lock on it or not? Will it go to a runoff vote? What are people expecting?
Well, many people, I think it's pretty much assumed that Karzai will eventually come out the winner. But there's a real question of whether he will win the 50% plus one that's required to declare him the winner now without going to a runoff election. There are several candidates who, if they took even a token measure of support, could together take up 49% of the vote. So you have Kanuni, who is probably the toughest rival to Karzai. He was a Northern Alliance commander from the coalition of militia leaders that the U.S. Cooperated with to throw over the Taliban. He's a strong contender. So is Abdul-Rashid Dostum, the one I mentioned in the Northwest, who may get a large percentage of the Uzbek vote. And Uzbeks are only 9% of the population, but when you start to add up these groups, it may stop Karzai from winning outright.
And Anne, what about U.S. forces at this election time? Are they highly visible? Are they back at bases? Will they be visible on election day?
Well, I think it depends on the region. In Kabul, there is a multinational NATO-led force that is out patrolling on patrols. There's a U.S. force that would serve as a quick reaction force in case of an emergency. Out in places like Gardez, you have a much smaller ratio, the troops are less visible just because you have a larger, more mountainous, more difficult to travel area. So the U.S. military has said they will be able to get to any polling place within an hour if there's an emergency, but that's a far cry from having a presence at every polling station. The immediate security is going to be provided by Afghan police, the Afghan army, and in some cases members of the militias that are supposed to be being phased out but are still required to help provide some of the security.
And we know how difficult transportation can be in Afghanistan. How long is it supposed to be until the outcome of tomorrow's vote is known?
Well, they're saying there won't be any early results. There certainly won't be any exit polls, in part because people were concerned that Afghans would be intimidated if someone asked them who they voted for as they walked out of the polling place. So there won't be any early returns until 2 days later, at least. And the final count won't be completed, they said, for, I think, 2 weeks.
And Anne, if you could just pull back the lens for a moment here. You've been reporting from Afghanistan for several weeks in advance of the election. Clearly a positive step in having a vote tomorrow. But you say that at the same time you report, this country is still at risk of descending into a kind of lawless narco state. Describe that balance to us.
Well, the U.S. military, as well as Afghan officials, say that the biggest security threat to Afghanistan right now for the long term is the drug economy, which has come back with a vengeance since the fall of the Taliban, who used extremely ruthless methods to cut back on it. You now have militia leaders in many parts of the country openly trafficking. Some of these people are longtime allies of the United States, and now the U.S. is starting to phase out their cooperation with these people, although some diplomats and organizations here complain that the United States should have taken that step a long time ago.
Anne Bernard, be safe in Kabul, and thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much.
Anne Bernard is a correspondent for the Boston Globe. She spoke with me from Kabul. We are talking tonight about Afghanistan and tomorrow's big election there. Joining me now from Kabul is Scott Baldoff, correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. He's been covering Afghanistan since March of 2001. Scott Baldoff, thanks very much for being there. I know it's a late hour in Kabul. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, yes.
Also with us from Kabul is Barbara Stapleton, advocacy and policy coordinator for the Agency Coordinating Body for Afghan Relief. It's the coordinating agency for Western NGOs in Afghanistan. She has been based in Kabul for the past 2 years. Barbara Stapleton, thank you very much for being with us at this late hour in Kabul.
It's a pleasure.
And with me here in Boston, Thomas Barfield. He's professor of anthropology at Boston University on the executive board of the American Institute for Afghan Studies. Thomas Barfield, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Scott Baldoff, let me go first to you. You've done a lot of serious reporting, but you had a light note the other day. You sat down with an Afghan astrologer and asked if he had any predictions for tomorrow's vote. What was his reply, and how does it relate to how Afghans are thinking about this vote?
Well, he essentially said, I don't do elections. His comment was roughly this, that governments have come and gone to Afghanistan. You know, this is all in God's hands. There was a really strong sense of this being out of the control, not just of him, but of many Afghans. And I think, to a certain extent, this is a very mysterious process for Afghans. This is the first time that they will be voting. It's also very interesting, maybe the first time that they will have seen themselves as individuals having a choice rather than members of a larger collective group, a tribe or an ethnic group. Here they're starting to be asked, what do you think, Mr. Afghan, instead of what do you think, member of the tribe? Do you agree that we will all choose this together?
And Barbara Stapleton, you've been watching Afghans for so long now, living in Afghanistan. Just give us a sense first of what you're hearing from Afghans about this vote, their personal expectations of it. Are they excited? How are they looking forward to it?
Well, there's a varying spectrum of response depending on the Afghans you speak to. The urban, educated, middle-class sector of society varies from quite a cynical view, feeling that the outcome of the election is preordained, and indeed some of them haven't even bothered to register and won't be voting because they feel there's no point in doing so, to those who feel it's a step in the direction that they hope Afghanistan will continue to proceed down, which is the future sustained peace and stability of the country in which development can go ahead. For the majority of the population, from the work that we do with civil society organizations, the view is very different. And from last November, civil society organizations have been reporting that at the grassroots, hopes are greatly raised in the concept of holding the elections, but they don't actually understand what that means. There's no concept of a secret ballot, for example. There's no common language on the building blocks of democracies as we would understand them in terms of what is a high court, what is a human rights violation, and so on and so forth. And the hopes are high that somehow just the act of holding the elections will magically transform the country, will deliver the just government that they long for, and will provide jobs and swift economic transformation. The concern is, of course, that these hopes are likely to be disappointed.
And Barbara, how are you looking at the election tomorrow? How do you assess the stakes here? What is at stake when Afghanistan's go to the polls tomorrow morning?
I think it's going to be very important to bear in mind that the parliamentary elections, which are scheduled at present for next April 2005, are the other half, if you like, and in some ways even a more important half of the process that's going to take place tomorrow. And I think the presidential elections will be judged in the light of how the new government, with hopefully the support of the international community, continuing support, approaches the holding of parliamentary elections next year. Because there's been many corners cut in the approach to the presidential elections that will not be possible for the holding of parliamentary elections. And the parliamentary elections will deliver the ultimate outcome, if you like, in terms of the democratic process. And the fear is, again, amongst educated Afghans and amongst long-term observers and people living here, that the powerful in the country will be able to manipulate the political process and be able to convert the parliamentary elections, their de facto power, into de jure power.
Tom Barfield, how are you looking at this election tomorrow? It's been 3 years since the bombing began and the U.S. invasion. Has the U.S. and the international community put Afghanistan in the proper position to hold this vote, to have it look and be credible, to have Afghanistan truly put its feet on the path of democracy?
Well, the main problem is that these elections have been pushed to the forefront in part because of their relations to the American elections, that the American government in particular would like to show a successful election, at least a successful election process. So the fact that so many people were registered took many people by surprise because it was felt that the Afghans would not be able to do that. So that was a credible step forward. But they did have to postpone the parliamentary elections, which are a much greater problem. But the real fear among many people looking at this is that perhaps Afghanistan might have been better off holding the election 6 months later when, for example, you could have international observers come to take care of them and when you could have enough security to make sure that you weren't holding the elections on a wish and a prayer.
We're talking tonight about Afghanistan on the eve of its big presidential election tomorrow. No calls tonight from listeners, I'm afraid, because we've recorded this early to get in our guests from Kabul before it gets too late in Afghanistan. I'm joined from Kabul tonight by Scott Baldoff, correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, Barbara Stapleton with the Agency Coordinating Body for Afghan Relief, and here with me in the studio in Boston, Thomas Barfield, professor of anthropology at Boston University. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Afghanistan and its big presidential election scheduled for tomorrow. The polls will open across Afghanistan in not too many hours' time now. We're hearing voices from Afghanistan tonight. Scott Baldoff with the Christian Science Monitor, Barbara Stapleton with the Agency Coordinating Body for Afghan Relief, the coordinating agency for Western NGOs in Afghanistan. With me here in Boston, Thomas Barfield, professor of anthropology at Boston University. He's on the executive board of the American Institute for Afghan Studies. And also joining us right now from Kabul, Afghanistan, Michael Kleinman. He is advocacy coordinator for CARE. CARE has been in Afghanistan for more than 30 years, been very active since the U.S. invasion 3 years ago. Michael Kleinman, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much for having me.
So I'm looking here at a statement from your country director for CARE that's just come out, and the headline is, CARE says Afghanistan elections should not be oversold. What's he saying there, Michael?
Well, just to reiterate some of the points that Barbara and Anne and the others made, there are amazingly high expectations around this election. In a survey of over 700 Afghan voters carried out by a consortium of humanitarian organizations, including CARE, an overwhelming majority, I think it was close to 85%, expected that the elections would result in immediate positive changes for Afghanistan. And our feeling at CARE is that given some of the flaws with the election process and given some of the large structural problems that Afghanistan faces, it's unrealistic to think that elections, no matter how important and no matter how great a symbolic value they have, will be able to suddenly transform what is an incredibly poor and still war-ravaged nation into either a functional democracy or a state which can provide security for all of its citizens. So really what we're concerned about is that Afghans and the international community will look at one or possibly 2 days of voting, declare victory, and then say, wonderful, the job is now done, when problems like the drug economy, problems like rampant warlordism, and the slow pace of disarmament are going to require years and years of sustained attention to deal with before we can talk about an Afghanistan which is able to provide just basic services for its citizens.
Scott Baldoff, you know that Afghanistan and its election have become a significant element in the U.S. elections. President Bush is declaring this even in advance of tomorrow's voting, a victory for American determination there, democracy brought to a land that has never really known it. What do you think, Scott, what can Washington fairly claim as its accomplishments at this point in Afghanistan, and what can it not claim?
What it can claim at this point is to have remained in place with some level of troops to preserve the basic peace in Afghanistan. But it has not been enough peace to provide sustained development across the country. And this is something that Barbara will be able to tell you about. A lot of NGOs, a lot of the aid workers have had to pull back from the more distant provinces to Kabul, and a lot of that sort of development work has had to slow down necessarily. In some cases, NGOs, one NGO, Médecins Sans Frontières, pulled out entirely from Afghanistan after about a dozen years here through some of the hardest fighting. Now they're deciding to leave because the security situation is not sufficient for development and relief work. So that's an area where they cannot claim success. But where they can claim success is a greater degree of political stability, a leadership at the top, at least, Hamid Karzai, that is predictable. But again, where is the system there? What happens if Hamid Karzai is not able to fulfill that job? Are we building this entire venture on one man? And what is plan B if, God forbid, Hamid Karzai is killed?
Of course, there's been a lot of work to make sure that doesn't happen. So much work, Scott, that he's barely been able to campaign. We saw him try to go out to Gardez. There was a rocket fired at his helicopter. It went right back to Kabul. We've repeatedly seen him surrounded by, I guess, a private American security guards. Has Hamid Karzai been able to interact with the voting public in Afghanistan at all in the run-up to tomorrow's vote?
Well, he did have this week. He had one campaign rally in the town of Ghazni, and he had one in Kabul as well on the final day of campaigning, which was Wednesday. But the ability of a politician to go out and press the flesh and kiss babies and to hug people, Hamid Karzai does not have that. He does not have the touch of the common anymore, mostly because to the extent that he has any contact with the people at all, they are people who have to come to him inside the palace through enormous security parameters. And you lose your perspective, I would imagine, over a period of time as to what the real man is thinking outside. And frankly, a lot of people are very frustrated with Hamid Karzai. They like him as a man. He seems like a nice fellow. He seems to say all the right things. But what has he done? He goes back to the question of development. There have been roads constructed, but in terms of creating jobs, in terms of creating a level of security that's sustainable and trustworthy, those areas, Hamid Karzai comes up very, very low on most Afghans' opinions.
Barbara Stapleton, how do you see Karzai? He's been in a very tight security bubble. We even read here that an American security guard smacked or slapped a government minister not long ago when he got too close to Hamid Karzai. Clearly a lot of tension about his personal safety there. But what about his record? Has he been able to exercise leadership? How is he seen by Afghans?
I think this is a critical question in that Karzai's government and Karzai himself, who's referred to often in the Afghan media, for example, as the mayor of Kabul, has failed to expand the authority and legitimacy of the government throughout the country. It's remained a very weak central government. That's nothing new in Afghan history, of course. But critically, his legitimacy has decreased due to the tolerance of his government at the district, provincial, and central levels of warlords, commanders known to be deeply involved in the narcotics trade, for example. Corruption has been skyrocketing, and if not directly involved, the government has tolerated this situation. Ordinary Afghans have no recourse against land grabs. Their legal documents count for nothing. There has been no establishment of the rule of law, and justice and law and order is the leading concern, has remained the leading concern of the Afghan people. So on a lot of counts, there is great disillusionment with his government. Now, I think there's a huge opportunity that has been created by the more assertive actions of the government of late in the west of the country, for example, and in other areas. And if there is steady progress towards removing those that the Afghan people consider to be illegitimate, then legitimacy of the government, if they can tackle things like skyrocketing corruption and establish the all-important law and order, will grow exponentially.
Barbara, let me ask you then, if there's so much disillusionment with Hamid Karzai, why is he the expected winner of this election tomorrow?
He's the expected winner because, despite the flaws to date, there really are not many credible, feasible options. People know that he has the backing of the international community. He's seen himself as not being a corrupt man and as still being a good person. But there are questions as to whether he has what it takes to continue leading Afghanistan in the direction that the Afghans want to see it go in. There really aren't, I don't think, that many credible alternatives that can challenge Karzai's victory.
Tom Barfield here with me in Boston. It's something to see. On the one hand, elections taking place, this looks like a big step forward, and who would not want to applaud it? On the other hand, we hear dire warnings about kind of narco state, lawless state, still lots of insecurity, the corruption we're just hearing about from our correspondents in Afghanistan, and even Anne Bernard, who we talked with earlier, her reporting saying that what Afghans want above all is security, and if they don't get it, they may ultimately even feel nostalgia for the Taliban. Does that seem realistic to you, or is that history now?
Well, the nostalgia is not history in part because people always look back on the positive period that they've just left, whatever it is. Some people even nostalgia for the communists. I mean, but doesn't mean they want them back in any sense.
So the Taliban, as a matter of power, you see as history?
Yes. In fact, while the day is still young and looking at the election, the Taliban threat to disrupt the registration, to wreak havoc throughout Afghanistan, has been a remarkably hollow promise.
Really has not materialized.
Has not materialized. And in part because the Taliban as a movement, as an ideology, was never very popular in Afghanistan. So for this reason, nobody really wants to see them back, but what they did bring, at least initially, was security. And people do, and they did hope with the international community and international troops, why can't there be security? And it's not, we're not talking about Iraq-style security of American troops patrolling villages. What we're talking about is warlord control. And had the international community sent a couple thousand troops to each of the major cities to say that the warlords are out of business, if you have any problem, come to us, that would have gone a long way. Instead, the international community hunkered down in Kabul and passed the table back to the regional leaders.
And Scott Baldoff, in Kabul, the United States has taken some criticism for actively embracing those warlords. How important are those warlord relationships to U.S. forces in Afghanistan now in terms of keeping the peace or stability? I'm not sure how you want to describe it. It doesn't sound like full security.
Well, it certainly is not full security. But that said, for quite a while, the U.S. was relying on what we now refer to as warlords to help them pursue their primary goal here, which is going after the Taliban remnants and mainly al-Qaeda. The Afghan militia forces, as they're called, still are a pretty vital component in going after these remnants, particularly down in the southern and southeastern parts of the country. And, you know, the Americans recognize they're dealing with people who are thugs, who are, you know, not going to be winning the Nobel Peace Prize anytime soon, and certainly are, in many cases, not very reliable. One in particular, Hazrat Ali down in Jalalabad, was the man who was on the ground. He and his troops were providing perimeter support during the Battle of Tora Bora, where a lot of al-Qaeda people, including some high leadership, were holed up in a cave complex. And in the end, many of the top leadership simply slipped away. The reliability of these commanders has been called into question many, many times. But what's the alternative? The Afghan National Army may have, at this point, 14,000 troops total. Police forces are around 17,000. The numbers are not sufficient to be able to provide what the Americans need if the Americans are not going to be here in large numbers themselves.
Michael Kleinman, we read recently the chief of staff for U.S.-led forces in Afghanistan, it's a Colonel David Lamb, saying that Osama bin Laden is a huge distraction, that what he feels like he's got to deliver above all is security to Afghans, a security that they're not getting, particularly in the south and southeast of the country. At CARE, you've expressed concern that while there are, 60 or 100,000 private militiamen in Afghanistan, there just aren't enough U.S. troops or trained Afghan troops or police at this point.
No, and that's certainly a huge problem. And it comes down to a few factors. First of all, as Scott was saying earlier, the pace of training the Afghan National Army and the Afghan police forces needs to be picked up significantly. There were sort of benchmark standards set for how many soldiers and how many police should be trained by 2005, and as of now, there's almost no chance of meeting those numbers. So in terms of providing long-term security, it's impossible unless there's a functional Afghan sort of military and police structure, and what that requires is sustained long-term international involvement to train this army, to equip it, and also to make sure that the government structures exist that the army will be used in an effective and efficient way. So the hunt for Osama bin Laden is, in some ways, it's obviously very important. But insofar as it takes away from concentrating on building up Afghan structures to deal with security problems, and insofar as it siphons off American soldiers from providing security throughout the country, in some ways it's counterproductive because U.S. troops could be in Afghanistan for years and years and never find Osama bin Laden. We have no idea. But in order for Afghanistan to never become a haven for al-Qaeda, a haven for terrorists, or even, as a number of people said, a narco state, it's important that all resources, or as many resources as possible, be poured into sort of creating a stable environment and a secure environment throughout Afghanistan, and not just in the south and the southeast, where the hunt for Osama bin Laden continues.
Barbara Stapleton, we've seen the number of 600 Afghan national police killed so far this year, the majority in the south. But a lot of aid workers have died as well. Give us a sense of what it's like away from Kabul, away from the population centers, trying to work on development in Afghanistan today.
I think the actual figure of NGO staff who've been killed this year is 23. That is, of course, a lot more than last year, where 13 national Afghan staff were killed. ACBAR, my organization, represents national Afghan NGOs as well as international NGOs. And, of course, we have a de facto split in the country, although there's insecurity in many different parts of the country. In the south and southeast, the number of high-risk areas, that is high risk to international agencies, to UN agencies, proliferate in the south, essentially. That has not led to a pullout of international NGOs who still continue to manage to work there through their national staff, largely, who are in the front line. And, of course, national NGOs are also working in those regions. And even where non-local staff and international staff do have to be pulled back because of the security situation, locally employed staff remain in place working. The situation now requires tremendous flexibility and adaptation on the part of international NGOs, some of whom have worked here for decades, are dusting off security plans and approaches that they utilized 10 years ago in the effort to keep delivering services to the Afghan people. Dakar, for example, which puts in irrigation services and other water supply programs, now focuses on having mobile teams who can swiftly reprioritize if a situation becomes difficult in a certain area. But I'd also like to emphasize that the Afghan people at the community level offer their protection. The NGOs work closely with Afghan communities. They have their acceptance and they have their protection. And this has been exemplified just recently around the elections, where communities have requested NGOs not to come in to work because they know they form a soft target. It's a difficult situation. It remains an increasingly challenging situation, but many NGOs, depending on what they do and how they do it, manage to continue to keep working in many parts of the country, even those that are deemed high risk.
We are talking tonight with voices from Afghanistan on the eve of Afghanistan's big presidential election. From Kabul, Barbara Stapleton, Michael Kleinman, and Scott Baldoff. With me here in Boston, Thomas Barfield. It is a big day for Afghanistan tomorrow, 3 years and a couple days after the first U.S. bombs dropped in the effort to kick out the Taliban. The Taliban is gone. What comes next, what comes on, even on the other side of these elections, is the question. We're getting a lot of views on that tonight. We can't take your calls because we recorded this earlier in order to get our Kabul guest before it was just too late there. But stick with us. A lot more to learn here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Afghanistan and its big presidential election tomorrow, the first in Afghan history. No calls tonight because we've recorded this early to get voices involved from Kabul, but we're glad to have them, and I think it's well worth it. Scott Baldoff with the Christian Science Monitor. I'd like to talk for just a moment about U.S. troops. There were 15 or 16,000. There have been 20,000 bulked up in advance of the election, and we understand there's been a change in the strategy of their deployment lately. Can you describe that for us?
The deployment is mainly as a reaction force in case something happens. They are spread out in bases around the country, mainly along the borders with Pakistan, in cities like Kandahar and towns such as Khost, in provinces such as Paktia, and then, of course, in Nangarhar. And there's a huge base here in Kabul. So in terms of facing an enemy that has an ability to take a city, to take territory away, in that sense, the U.S. is facing an enemy that simply doesn't exist. But what they are facing is an enemy that can strike and leave in guerrilla fashion. And this is an area where, frankly, many U.S. troops themselves feel that there aren't enough troops to be able to make a difference. And maybe there never could be against that sort of an enemy. All the more reason to train up more Afghan forces to be able to do it themselves and to infiltrate those ranks to neutralize them.
And Michael Kleinman, we understand that U.S. troops have been formed into what they call provincial reconstruction teams, smaller garrisons in local communities more often. If I've got this right, are your care operatives seeing those troops in the field, seeing how they interact with Afghans for security, for reconstruction? How successful is that interaction?
No, there are no care staff, and there's really no staff of almost any international NGO which works closely with these provincial reconstruction teams, or PRTs. As a matter of fact, the whole idea of PRTs is somewhat problematic, because what the military does best, what it was trained to do, is to fight wars and provide security. And all of a sudden, we're taking men off the front line, so to speak, though they do have a security aspect to their work, and asking them to do reconstruction, development. It's basically like taking a policeman off the street and then without really any training, asking him to build a school or a clinic. So one problem with PRTs is that they're not particularly efficient. They're not particularly good at doing this development work that they're set out to do. Another problem with PRTs is that they blur the line between what's military action and what's humanitarian action. And what that means at the end of the day, as Barbara was speaking about, it becomes simply a much more dangerous environment for humanitarian aid workers to operate. When you have roads in a remote province and one day a white Land Cruiser goes down the road and it's carrying humanitarian staff, 3 days later a white Land Cruiser goes down that road and it's carrying military soldiers, PRTs, who when confronted with enemy fire, enemy action can then call in an airstrike or what have you, it tends to create a lot of confusion as to who's who and how closely do humanitarian organizations work with the military. So our position is that the military's focus should not be on PRTs, should not be on these provincial reconstruction teams doing development work, but instead should be on providing security for the country as a whole, which is really a precondition for anything else to happen.
Tom Barfield, here's the quandary. On the one hand, everyone's saying you need more troops. There's one foreign soldier between for every 1,115 Afghans, compared with one foreign soldier for every 161 Iraqis, one for every 66 in Bosnia. This is a thin foreign deployment. The U.S. clearly looking for the right formula of how to use and deploy, how much strong arm, how much development. Without development, Afghanistan's a mess. Without security, you can't have development. How do you look at this balance?
Well, one of the problems is that the balance was never there, that the administration was so keen to get on with the war in Iraq that it left a minimal number of troops and mostly war fighters along the Pakistan-Afghan border. The rest of the country was left to its own devices. Kabul was secured by international forces now under UN control. But it's not just the United States. None of the UN members have been willing to give even a minimally adequate number of troops or equipment to be involved within this. So when we're looking, for example, at PRTs, we're certainly not looking at an ideal situation where, indeed, the military should establish security and development workers should do their jobs. But what happens in a situation when the international community has been absolutely unwilling to put in even the minimum number of troops in most parts of the country? We get these sort of hybrids of PRTs because, legitimately so, NGOs do not want to go into areas where they're going to be shot at. And this is sort of a hybrid. It's a little bit of a horse and a donkey, and we got ourselves a mule. what we have are people that will shoot back if shot at, and they give out money to fix things, build schools, this and that. And they also come in two varieties. Those that are along the Pakistan border are effectively hearts and minds of an active military operation. That's where most of the American troops are. But the other PRTs that are staffed by non-Americans, like the New Zealanders, like the British, like the Germans in Kunduz, these are effectively units that are not war-fighting units. They're in areas where the Taliban and al-Qaeda are not particularly active. And they provide a certain amount of screening to do minimal development work. But one of the big problems here is that the NGOs still largely provide humanitarian aid, and Afghanistan needs reconstruction. The NGOs have done a great job on humanitarian
aid. Not bandages, but bridges.
Bridges, roads, mm-hmm. irrigation systems, and to some extent, no one has really bitten the bullet to say, why do we bring in companies like Halliburton and other multinationals to rebuild roads when we should be demobilizing the Afghan militia, paying them the same amount of money, pay them $5 a day.
When you say the militia, you mean warlord troops?
I mean warlord militia, because mm-hmm. who's going to give up his gun, his militia position, unless he's got a job to replace it? What you want to do is get rid of their guns, but give them other work. What you'd really like to see is have them work on roads for 6 months, and when you're told there's no more work, you have a labor riot. We want more roads.
Mm-hmm.
People are looking for that transition. And the other thing you really need is to have the local population receiving the money to do the work. So much of even the road construction, the killings of Chinese in Kunduz province, they were there to rebuild roads. They were not engineers. What does Afghanistan need Chinese laborers to rebuild roads when you have millions of unemployed Afghans? Too much of the international community has said, how can our corporations, how can our people be involved? Nobody has asked, how can we use Afghan labor and pay Afghans to do this?
Scott Baldoff, the indigenous Afghan industry that we're hearing more and more about is the drug trade, the cultivation of opium, poppies, heroin. I guess Afghanistan is now the world's leading source. How significant is that to the economy? Does anything come close to it in terms of scale? And where does all that money go?
Well, last year, it was about $2.3 billion as an industry, which is about half the economy of the country. And what is more dangerous is that the opium income was about 70% more than all of the aid that was sent from the United States and from other countries into Afghanistan. So the influence of drugs are so much more powerful than even the best that the international community has to offer. That said, when you go out as a reporter and you talk to Afghan farmers, frankly, they just want to make a living. And unfortunately, it's hard to make money off of wheat, especially when wheat is being brought in to the country to feed people for free, when the state controls the prices of wheat and keeps it rather low. So it's impossible to make a profit. If there were some changes in agricultural policy, if there were some incentives to go to alternatives, I think you would see a sizable percentage of those farmers, not all of them, go to something that they are more comfortable with, religiously speaking, and that still pays the bills.
Barbara Stapleton, $2.3 billion is a huge amount of money in a country with Afghanistan's economy. Where does that money go? Who's benefiting, who's gaining power from the drug trade?
Well, the drug trade basically fuels the resources of all those who are opposed to a future Afghanistan which is peaceful, which is stable, which has a stronger central government and the establishment of law and order, essentially. The Afghans know well that there are economic relations between groups who are even ideologically opposed to each other. For example, local commanders, power holders in the north, Taliban forces and others that may be present in the south, they come together over the interests of making a profit for their mutual different agendas. You see building booms in all the main cities. These are largely fueled by opium money, the black market. The sorts of buildings that are being largely built are expensive housing for those who presumably are benefiting from the black market rather than the kind of affordable housing for the huge number of returning refugees for the IDPs. It's a very dangerous situation.
Scott Baldoff, another question for you on Afghan women. We understand that 41% of the registered voters, this famous 10.5 million, are women. Are they free to exercise that vote tomorrow? How is their place in Afghan society evolving in the 3 years since the U.S. invasion?
Well, yes, clearly 41% was a number that made people very, very happy, and there is an expectation that a large percentage of the voters who will turn out tomorrow will be women. One of the concerns is that if there are attacks, that the number of women voters in particular will diminish. When we were down in Kandahar on a trip and we asked people, are you going to let your women go out and vote? And this is a Pashtun area. Many people thought they wouldn't let them out at all. A lot of men were saying, what we'll do is in the morning, we will go out, we will vote ourselves. If there are any attacks, then we will keep our women home and not allow them out. So a lot is going to depend on the security situation as to whether we see a large women's voice in this election.
And Tom Barfield, the big point here was to make Afghanistan not only democratic and stable on its own terms, but to see this as a laboratory for democracy across the whole region, for a big chunk of the Islamic world that has not known democracy. If Afghanistan gets this vote, elects a president, moves on to parliamentary elections, do we have a model emerging here for a region that has not known democracy?
Well, one of the problems of having Afghanistan as a model is that it's almost a unique country. It has a subsistence economy. It's never been properly developed. It's not got an industrial base. So both its strengths and weaknesses are engaged in this process. That is, both the Afghan current government is very keen to get some legitimacy through an election. The Afghan people seem to be keen to go through at least a ritual of democracy. It's the first time they've ever been asked to choose a leader. But the difficulty comes when we look at the neighbors. To the north, the ex-Soviet republics of Central Asia are unlikely to take this. Pakistan has, in theory, a democracy, but we see Musharraf mostly violates it. Iran has actually had many more democratic elections, but the mullahs keep overriding that. And also, Afghanistan is not part of the Arab world. So the whole question of whether the lessons of Afghanistan will be seen as a model in other parts of the Islamic world, which we often forget is quite diverse, and the Arabs don't see a whole lot of kinship with the Afghans, so I'm not sure how far it'll necessarily go.
Barbara Stapleton, just give us a peek into your heart tonight on the eve of these elections. You've spent 2 years in Afghanistan. Here's the vote coming up. How are you feeling about the future of this country?
I really hope that these elections will be a step further down the road to peace and stability, the peace and stability that these people long for so much after 23 years of intermittently, unbelievably violent war, the total devastation of the former status quo, of the ways in which Afghan society conducted itself. The Afghans often talk about wanting to go back to a kinder past. Things have become much coarser, much less kind than they were in the 1960s, 1970s. Many returning Afghans who've been out of the country for over 20 years are shocked by the change in ambience at the street level, for example. And it's going to take time to build up that trust and confidence. They are war exhausted. That cannot be overemphasized. And more than anything else, peace and stability for the future development of the country, but peace and stability first and foremost is what they long for. And I think there is continuing confusion and uncertainty as to whether the bond process, which the international community has insisted on keeping on track in terms of the very ambitious timetable of just over 2 years that it's been on, whether this track is actually headed ultimately to ensuring that peace and stability, or whether it will return Afghan actors, political actors, who the Afghan people long to consign to the past, to their future. That is the great question.
Well, a milestone approaching tomorrow for Afghanistan, but what it means may take some time to sort out. Very grateful to all of you for being with us tonight. In Kabul, Barbara Stapleton with the Agency Coordinating Body for Afghan Relief. Thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
And Michael Kleinman, Advocacy Coordinator for CARE in Kabul, Afghanistan. Thank you for joining us there, Michael.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
And Scott Waldoff, Correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Always great speaking with you. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
And Thomas Barfield, with me here in Boston, Professor of Anthropology at Boston University, member of the Executive Board of the American Institute for Afghan Studies. It's been great having you. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.